Good afternoon. You're in session 124, Dermatology for the Non-Dermatologist. It's my pleasure this afternoon to introduce Edna Atwater. Edna is currently the Associate Operating Officer of Ambulatory Services, the Administrative Director of Wound Management and Reconstructive Plastic Surgery, and Healthcare Administrator of Dermatology at Duke University Hospital. And in her spare time, she's been able to come and join us here in San Antonio. The majority of Edna's nursing career has been focused in the specialty of dermatology. She also served as the president of the Dermatology Nurses Association in 1991. Ms. Atwater has also served on numerous national committees focusing on wound care for patients and regulatory guidelines. She's given lectures across the country on various subjects specific to the specialty of dermatology and wound care. Please join me in welcoming Edna Atwater.
Well, I'll have to tell you a little secret. Can you hear me? Okay, so first of all, I'll issue my usual disclaimers. I've been told I have a southern accent, but I'm not sure if any of you are picking up on that. It's a little early, so I'll just mention that for you. It may make things easier for you. Secondly, she tried really hard to get me to give her some dates, like how long have you been a nurse or how long have you been in dermatology. It's been a while. I actually started my career in dermatology nursing 29 years ago, and yes, I was a toddler. Just very gifted at the time. So how many of you were in the previous lecture that was in this room with Dr. Kravitz? Okay, good. It was phenomenal. I think you all would agree. This is a very different type of lecture related to dermatology. Really what I've tried to do is put together a presentation for you that's very basic, that looks, but also looks at those pieces of evaluating a patient from the dermatologic perspective that sometimes get overlooked in our practice. So, again, we're going to be able to, at the end of this presentation, I hope, recognize some of those common and atypical benign skin lesions that you see on your patients every day in your practice. I want you to be able to identify the common malignant lesions of the skin, and that really is a high priority for me, as you'll see as we go through this presentation. And then we'll talk some about some treatment options as we go through this talk. So Skin Anatomy 101, for those of you that were just in this in a lecture, I certainly wouldn't attempt to cover the in the level of detail that Dr. Kratz did. So, but I think it is important, you know, when we think about, again, when we look at that typical presentation of the skin as we're thinking about the lesions that we're seeing on the patient's skin, the wounds that we're seeing, think about that structure and function of those layers of the skin. That was your skin anatomy. Again, basic functions of the skin. I just need to take you back and just remind you, dust it off. For some of you, may it not have been as long as it has been for me, but it goes without saying, you can't talk about dermatology and skin care without talking about those functions of the skin. Again, protection, homeostasis, excretion, temperature regulation, vitamin D production, sensory perception, the psychosocial issues associated with skin care, and we'll talk about that in a bit. And, of course, the big reason that many of us are here, wound healing. In these times now, this is certainly dear to most of you in the room, how many of you are working in an acute care setting? Okay. Long-term care? Okay. So I think it goes without saying, I really would be understating the issue if I didn't say that assessment of the skin and appropriate documentation of that assessment has never been more important than it is now. When we look at the regulatory issues associated with patients with breakdown in the skin that are presenting to various care settings, and now it's always been important. We've always taught that. We've always known that. But interestingly, it's important, has certainly heighten when we attach a monetary connotation with that. So just as a review, so when you're taking a patient history and assessing the patient's skin, I'll have to tell you, one of the things that's really one of my pet peeves when I look at some of our H&Ps of our patients at Duke, that, you know, we have that category called skin, and it says intact. And that's it. You know, now this may be a patient that's in the hospital with a blistering eruption, but the skin's intact. Or the patient with psoriasis, with psoriatic lesions all over their body, but it's intact. Or, my second favorite, WNL, you know, within normal limits. So, we need to do better. I think when we are assessing a patient's skin, and particularly those patients that present in a wound care clinic or certainly in a dermatologic clinic, you need to get that subjective data from the patient, look at their family history, past medical history, what medications the patient's on. We know many occupations have dermatologic implications associated with the type of work a patient's doing. Social history, all very important in that subjective data when you're assessing a patient's skin. Some tips for visual examination, and again, assessment of a patient's skin is a whole nother lecture within itself. But some of the really critical things, use a good light source. A few years ago at Duke, they finally took dermatology out of the basement of the organization, which was phenomenal. And for those of you that are in large teaching hospitals, you know that, those surgery clinics are up there on the first floor with all the lights, and the dermatology clinics are kind of tucked away in the corner. But we really fought for this when we renovated this building, so we have a natural light source, which is really critical in evaluating a patient's skin. Conduct a skin assessment in an orderly fashion. You know, start from head to toe. Don't forget the patient's hair and their nails. Palpate lesions to determine some of those diagnostic characteristics. Assess for alterations in skin color. We'll talk about this a little more as we go through. And evaluate again for moisture, turgor, texture, and elasticity. So when you assess the skin, what are you looking at? What are you going to be expected to describe? Well, you're going to need to think about it. Is this a primary or secondary lesion? How do you describe what you find? And what are some of those diagnostic clues associated with skin with lesion location? So, is it a primary or a secondary lesion? Primary lesions, key thing, are caused directly by the disease process. And secondary lesions are really the skin's response to a disease process. So, in describing a patient's lesions that you find on the patient's skin, when we talk about primary skin lesions, you really need to be able to talk the talk. So, we're going to talk through what are some of these dermatologic descriptions of lesions that you may find, because I can tell you, an accurate description of the lesion is really critical when you are communicating amongst caregivers about the lesions that you see on a patient's skin. You're really not going to want to document, the patient's got a red lump or a red bump. That doesn't tell us a lot. So, it'll be a little painful, but we're going to go through and really I want to give you kind of some of the tidbits associated with these dermatologic descriptors. So when you're looking at a patient's skin, we'll start with the macule, it's a round, flat discoloration of the skin. It might be brown, it might be blue, it might be red, it might be hypopigmented. But the key word is that the lesion is flat. A common macule that you see in sun exposure areas are just that typical freckle. But again, it's a flat discoloration of the skin, and it's round. So papule, that's an elevated lesion up to a half a centimeter in diameter, and the color may vary. But your key things to take home, it's elevated, and it's up to 5 millimeters in diameter. So some of the common examples, the lesions associated with measles, which we don't see much in this country, thank goodness. Acne lesions typically are less than a half a centimeter in diameter. A plaque. So a plaque is a slightly raised lesion of the skin, but it's a defining characteristic. It's greater than a centimeter in diameter. So key. It's slightly raised. It's greater than a centimeter. And I think I mentioned those lesions of psoriasis. So typically the psoriatic lesion is a slightly raised lesion, and it's greater than a centimeter in diameter. A nodule, solid raised lesion, more than a half a centimeter in diameter. Large nodules we refer to simply as tumors. Key. So it's solid. it's raised, and it's greater than a half a centimeter. A wheal. A wheal is that firm, red, transient plaque, which typically results from infiltration of the dermis with fluid. And we'll typically see that, you know, as a fairly immediate response to an insect bite or more typically hives. So, keyword, wheals are always red. They're transient. And they're a plaque. And there's a typo here. Well, yeah, I must have been tired. So, can anybody tell me what, let me just see how well people are listening. So, can somebody tell me what the typo is on this slide? Now, this is one quiet group. Okay, so the typo is here where I'm giving you the hint about a plaque. If I'd been paying really good attention when I looked at these slides for the, you know, 50th time, I would have seen that I have the wrong descriptor there for a plaque, because a plaque is raised, but it's greater than 1 centimeter in diameter. Okay? We're going to have a test. Okay? Stay with me. So a pustule. A pustule is that yellowish or whitish elevation of the skin that we all love to see. And it's usually filled with purulent exudate. Key word again, it's elevated. It has a yellowish or whitish top on it, and it usually has purulent data. And it's typically what you see in a patient with folliculitis or that patient with acne vulgaris. A vesicle. It's that circumscribed collection of free fluid up to a centimeter in diameter. And it's, again, fluid on the skin. A common example is a lesion you see with herpes zoster, and we're going to talk about that a little bit more as we go. A bulla, you know, the most common name for a bulla is typically a blister, but we're not going to call it a blister. If you're in dermatology, we're going to call it a bulla. So it's a circumcised collection of free fluid more than a half a centimeter in diameter. It's very superficial in nature, and it ruptures easily. So are you having fun yet? Okay. That was the painful part. But I think it's very important for us to be able to communicate with each other as caregivers. And for any of you who've ever seen that note from a dermatologist, it's going to have those descriptors in there. So it's critical for you to understand that. And also, again, with the present on admission issues and the diligence that we certainly need to apply when a patient comes and enters our organization, be it an acute care facility or long-term care facility, we need to be able to describe what we see so that others know what we saw on that patient. So that's the fun. Okay, so now we're going to spend a few minutes talk about secondary lesions, and we're going to start putting this information together. So assessment of the skin, again, secondary lesions, it's the skin's response to a disease process, okay? So it can be a scale that forms, a crust, a fissure, lichenification from constant scratching, an erosion, an ulcer, all of these things are secondary lesions, okay? So, I really am going to test to see if you're awake now, okay? So, is this a primary or a secondary lesion? And which one of these, the following, best describes this lesion? Okay. Ready? So, I'm hearing macule. I think I heard papule. Okay. And I also heard nodule. Okay. Is it a primary or secondary lesion? Okay. All right. If you said primary, you were correct. There's a new car outside the door for the person who got primary. Okay. It's red, so if you don't like red, don't leave the room yet. So, and this is also a nodule. Now, what makes it, why is this lesion not, why is it not described as a papule? Very good. So it's larger than 5 millimeters in diameter. Okay. See, it was easy. So this dermatologic terminology is not tough. Very good. Okay. want to spend a little while talking about some of the common benign lesions that you see on a patient's skin, because I know that you see them. And it's interesting to me that when patients and their families come to the wound care clinic, you know, we're so focused on the wound, but then they'll very quickly get us focused on, can you tell me what this is? You know, so I'm going to give you some of those tools of the trade, so to speak. So these are those non-cancerous lesions of the skin. They have no malignant potential, and they may require treatment for cosmetic purposes. Okay, one of the most common that you see. And they're lovely, aren't they? You know, and as we gain maturity, typically all of us get some of these at some point in time. Commonly known as skin tags, but us folks in dermatology like to call them acrocordons. Typically seen in areas where there's friction, although we really don't know what the cause for the development of skin tags. Some people seem to really grow them. But they're typically described as a flesh color, tan, or brown growth, usually found around the neck, the axilla, eyelids, or groin. So all of these areas where friction is occurring. But isn't it beautiful? And wouldn't you just like to just pick that right off of there? I can't imagine. Yeah. So what's the treatment? You know, it doesn't require anything, but you can snip these things right off very easily in an outpatient setting. And typically, we remove these things when they're troublesome for the patient. But again, it's a benign lesion. It's extremely common in the population. Never turns into a skin cancer. Of course, I know better than to never say never, but really no malignant potential has ever been identified with an acrocordon. Another very common lesion that you may see in a patient in a wound care clinic, it's called a dermatofibroma. It is a benign tumor consisting of fibrous connective tissue. It frequently occurs in middle age, and it's more predominant in females. And as you can see, the predominant location for this dermatofibromas is typically the lower leg. Now, what's a diagnostic sign? Really, that a diagnostic sign for this lesion is if you pinch this lesion, it dimples. Okay? And, of course, typically, you know, when female patients come in, they, you know, can you get this thing off? And the hazards to that is that you can remove surgically a dermatofibroma scarring, though it's a real concern. So if you're concerned about the way the lesion looks, you're not going to like that scar that you're going to get on the lower extremity. We will sometimes use liquid nitrogen treatments, which is, you know, repeated freezing of the area may cause some resolution. Again, one of the drawbacks to that type of treatment, you run the risk of permanent pigment changes. So it's a totally benign lesion that's very common. Keloids. Now, typically, you don't see keloids to this extent, but keloids are very common. And they represent an overabundance of collagen fibers within a site of trauma. And I always call it, you know, it's healing gone wild. It's more prevalent among African Americans and Asians. And they're never present at birth, and you rarely see a keloid on an individual before puberty. Well, I've had the pleasure of being involved with we started a keloid clinic at Duke about 25 years ago. Again, I was a toddler. But we started this clinic about 25 years ago when we had some funding for a study to look at some treatment options for patients with keloids. Of course, the funding ran out, but the patients didn't. And fortunately, we had several faculty at Duke that were really interested in providing service and care to these patients. So we probably have one of the largest keloid outpatient populations in the Southeast, where these patients come once a month to get treatment for their keloids. So, and again, the list is long of treatments for patients with keloids. The results are very varied, and I can stand before you today and almost tell you the same thing that I could tell you about the effectiveness of keloid treatment 15 years ago. So intralesional steroid injections probably top the list of treatments for patients with keloids, and that involves injecting high-dose steroid into the keloid. topical retinoid acid has been used. Some folks have used carbon dioxide laser. I will tell you, any of these surgical interventions, if they're not accompanied by steroid treatments, intralesional steroids, then the keloid will return, so the patient won't be any better off as a result of the surgical excision. Can't tell you how many patients we have that we see that had a surgical intervention for their keloid, and now they tell us that, you know, it's back and it's worse than it was, which stands to reason because, it's healing gone wild. So some of the, like I said, list is long. Results are really varied in the treatment of this difficult benign condition. Seborrheic keratoses, we sometimes hear those referred to as senile wart. If you're over the age of 50, there's not anybody in here that looks like they are. It's a very common in middle age and older adults, and it is inherited as a dominant trait. So if your parents have these waxy, thickened patches on their skin, more likely than not, you will as well. Isn't that something to look forward to? So the treatment for seborrheic keratosis. Now, if you or I had this, we'd want something done, I'm quite certain. But there's none necessary if they're typically asymptomatic. Patients will sometimes tell us that they itch and they just don't like the way they look. So there's a wide variety of ways to treat these things with superficial shave excisions. You can do a little electrodesiccation and curettage and remove the area quite well. CO2 laser is used, although a little high-tech for what needs to be done for these things, because, like I say, a little local anesthetic and a little electrodesiccation and curettage will typically take care of that. So we're going to shift gears just a little bit, if you'd stay with me, and we're going to talk a little bit about some of the common malignancies found on the skin. And for those of you that were in the previous lecture, certainly Dr. Kratz alluded to, they're generally found on sun-exposed areas of the body. And these malignancies that we're going to talk about are those that are confined to the skin, or typically confined to the skin. Number one, skin cancer is a basal cell carcinoma. Clinical characteristics almost make it diagnostic by looking at this lesion. It's typically a nodular growth on a sun-exposed area of the patient that the patient relates to you, this place just won't heal up. And if you look really closely, I think my cell phone's going to ring, which is just really a no-no. It is. That's my daughter. Nursing student, so I'm sure she has some drama to tell me about her clinical from today, but it'll have to wait. Typically, when you look at a basal cell, and again, good light is critical, you're going to see a shiny, kind of translucent area with a pearly hue, and that's the way people over and over describe a primary basal cell. And again, most common on sun-exposed surfaces. This is a patient, you know, I show this to you, this is the lower leg of a patient, and I can't tell you the number of patients that we've had sent to the wound care clinic at Duke with a wound on the leg that won't heal. And we take a look at this, and this photograph, you really can't appreciate it as much with this photograph, but, you know, this wound's never going to heal because this wound's a basal cell. You'll hear me say this, and the folks that know me will hear me say this. If there's a wound on a patient that's been there 6 to 8 weeks and it's shown no progress towards healing in the absence of underlying metabolic conditions, there's really no excuse for you not to have a biopsy done of that wound. It's really just kind of diagnostics 101. This patient had started with a small eroded area, and by the time she was sent to us, this basal cell, yeah, as you can see, was fairly significant. But they'd used lots of wound care products on the patient. Again, another one of the things that I've become very concerned about. I see us getting so enamored with all of the wonderful topical wound care products that we have today, but I think sometimes we need to remind ourselves, let's step back and look at, okay, first of all, let's look at what caused this wound on this patient and what else is contributing to that, because again, it doesn't make any difference what product from the exhibit hall we put on that until we get rid of the cancer in the wound, it's not going to heal. Another, you know, second most common skin cancer that we see in this country is the squamous cell carcinoma. So, and I'll show you, I'm sure you're thinking, okay, well, she forgot malignant melanoma. I didn't. And I'm going to show it to you a little later on in this presentation because that's a totally different animal when we talk about malignant melanoma of the skin. Just going to shift gears a little bit. Talk to you just a few minutes about some of the common skin infections, because I'll guarantee you if you're seeing patients in a wound care clinic, there aren't many days that go by that a patient can come in and have some type of skin infections. I just want to kind of give you just kind of a little review. So, and I'll start with bacterial skin and skin infections. This was, again, another patient sent to the wound care clinic for us to heal the patient's wound that the patient's primary care practice had been trying for some time to heal. This patient came with a kind of an unremarkable history of a blunt trauma to the lower leg that just wouldn't heal up even after 6 months. It was extremely painful, but no one had ever done a tissue culture of this wound, and the patient didn't have any underlying conditions. She, like most people over the age of 50, had some venous insufficiency, but not really remarkable. What really was happening with this patient is she needed systemic treatment for Klebsiella that was in this wound. Another bacterial infection. Again, all of these are patients that were sent to the wound care clinic, having been in the healthcare system for several months, most of these patients, being treated with a wide variety of topical products with little to no response, and what the patient needed was a diagnosis. So this patient had a mycobacterium infection. Shift gears from the bacterial infections that you're going to see. I think my take-home point about the bacterial infections, again, for patient, if it doesn't look right to you, it's not progressing along the typical course that you would see from a trauma, and we all know what that is, then we need to make sure that we're not dealing with a bacterial infection in a wound. Viral skin infections, I think one of the most common that we see, certainly in this country, is herpes zoster. And just want to kind of just remind people of the basics of zoster, which are, that wonderful thing we call shingles. And it's an acute vasculobulous eruption that occurs in a dermatonal distribution. Everybody know what dermatonal distribution, simple way of saying it, follows the nerve, ganglion nerve pathways, doesn't cross the center of the body typically. And it's caused by a reactivation of the varicella virus, so chickenpox. So, things to remember about patients with shingles. If you haven't had chickenpox, you can't have shingles. Okay? So, and if you haven't had chickenpox and you're exposed to a patient with shingles, you can have chickenpox. So, those really kind of are important points to remember, particularly when you think about, of course, we don't see much chickenpox in this country now, certainly not like we did 20 years ago with the immunizations, but which causes it does put some patient populations at risk because they haven't been exposed to the virus. Fungal infections. This is a really common fungal infection. How many of you have seen patients with Tinea versicolor, which is that, just that splotchiness. Those of you that are into horses, kind of looks like an Appaloosa horse. But it's a very superficial but chronic skin infections, typically located on the upper half of the body. As a matter of fact, I've never seen tinea below the waist. The typical manifestations, what you see here in this slide, you've got multiple circular macules of varying color. most obvious in the summer, and that's typically when we see patients come into our practice with these spots that they want us to take away, is after they've gone out and had a tanning episode or spent some time in a tanning booth, and they these spots become apparent, because until the fungus is treated, the skin will not pigment. Some really basic treatments for patients with tinea. You know, patients can be given systemic antifungals, but some of the really just basic dermatologic treatments that we continue to recommend today that are very effective is, you know, selenium sulfide shampoo, so Celsum Blue shampoo that you can buy right over the counter, or topical ketoconazole, or any of the sulfur or zinc-containing shampoos. Now, it's messy because you have to tell the patient to cover themselves and extend it, you know, several centimeters beyond the area of infection. So you've got shampoo that's, you know, very cosmetically pleasing that you should sleep in, you know, and but it's very effective in relieving tinea. So what I threw together and put some what I call some miscellaneous lower extremity lesions. So again, that I won't call it a pet peeve, I'll just call it passion, that, you know, oftentimes, you know, systemic diseases can manifest themselves with simple, rather benign looking lesions of the skin. Again, diagnostic skills critical to ask yourself that question: is it more than skin deep? So, and I think there's a great photograph, actually a poster in the exhibit hall that really shows you those lesions that are typical and that may occur in the patient with uncontrolled diabetes. So, you know, very, very rarely do you see these types of lesions in the diabetic patient that has good glycemic control. Vasculitis, another one of those, and I'll promise, I swear to you, I'm not making this up. You know, another patient sent to us for wounds of the lower extremity that, in fact, were idiopathic vasculitis. Some of the drugs that cause lower extremity wounds, Hydrea being one of those culprits that can really cause a nasty wound of the lower extremities. Unfortunately, we seem to have seen a rash of these patients. All of these photographs, by the way, are patients, again, that were seen in our outpatient wound care clinic. Coumadin or heparin certainly can cause this nasty anticoagulant necrosis. We seem to have a rash of that in some of our transplant patients at one point, or patients that were on dialysis. That's an interesting kind of event. Some hematologic abnormalities, again, that can end up with some of those hypercollaborable states like lupus and protein C deficiencies. You can see chronic wounds develop in the patient, but, you know, it's really a wound that's telling you something about that host that it's on. Very common, we have a large sickle cell population that receives care at Duke, and they actually have hired a wound care nurse to work in the sickle cell clinic because of the incidence of the high incidence of these wounds that are seen in the lower extremity of sickle cell patients. So I have to tell you this little story. I was asked to give a lecture similar to this for the National Orthopedic Nurses Association meeting, and as I was going through some of my slides and some of the ones you're about to see, I thought, well, I think people are hearing me in spite of the accent, because the poor AV guy was scratching himself to death. So I thought, so he's paying attention. Of course, there were a few in the room that were looking around at their skin. So I wanted to show you some really, you know, not the most common thing that you'll see, but when you see it, you know you've seen it and you know what it is. Okay, so this is, and I think it's a great, we get excited when we can really document these bizarre things. So as you can see, this little creeping little worm-like area in the patient's skin, we commonly refer to it as the creeping eruption. It usually resolves itself in about 4 to 6 weeks, And the creature in the previous photo often contributes to this condition. Okay. Anybody know what this is? Somebody. Who said that? Yeah, excellent. So there it is. The answer is cutaneous larval migraines, and it's caused by the hookworm, common in dogs and cats. They live in the soil and can penetrate the human skin, and they die because, humans aren't really good hosts for this organism. But trying to talk a patient through, you know what, the thing's going to die and I'll be over with in 4 to 6 weeks is a hard sell for the patient, as you could see. Really, this is a classic symptom for a very common skin eruption in this country. You know, classic sign being, as you can see, you see these little areas of the excoriation between the fingers. It's extremely itchy, especially at night, and it occurs only in close contact with the host or may be transmitted via clothing and bed linen. So you guys know what this is? That's right. And this is one of my favorite slides, which is, I guess, a little sad. But oftentimes when you're trying to diagnose scabies, particularly in dermatology, we'll take a slide and scrape some of the material from around the area the patient's telling us is very itchy, and then we'll put a little mineral oil on the slide and look at it under the microscope. And typically when you do that, the diagnosis of scabies is usually confirmed because you'll see one part of the scabies mite or some other discrete evidence. In this, let me see if I can get this pointer. In this slide, what was really great about it was, I don't know that I can, the pointer's dying. Okay, so I'll talk you through and let you use your, I'll see if I can get your imagination to go with me. So the large dark area that you see is an actual adult scabies mite. Okay, so the whole thing. Those egg-like things that you see in this slide are actually the eggs that are living on the skin. Is anybody itching? Mm-hmm. I see a few of you. Yeah. So, and the dark areas that you see towards the top of the slide are actually fecal material from the scabies mite. So we got a little bit of all of the creature on one slide, and we were just thrilled. I had some residents that were just so excited, and I think we got this slide off of a patient about 20 years ago, and people are still using it, because it's very unusual to get all the components of the scabies mite when you're checking for scabies. This intense scratching could result, and we've seen patients that come in actually with a secondary infection of the skin. That's typically what brings them into the practice. But what can be devastating is a scabies infection in the immunocompromised patient, because these mites really can multiply unchecked in that patient with a compromised immune system. So treatment of scabies, again, the medication of choice, I think, still used by dermatologists, a product called Elamite. It's actually a cream that's rubbed on the patient's skin, kills the mite. The real work is cleansing all of those household items, the clothing and the linen, and if it's a child, those little stuffed animals that they like to sleep with. So can I get your attention? You guys have done really well considering the time of day. So I told you I'd get back to that malignant melanoma. And I'll tell you, if nothing else I have shared with you today stays with you, I really need you to learn this acronym and ingrain it in you, because you have such an opportunity when you're seeing patients in your practice and even looking at your own family. Certainly, I think most of us, when we look at a lesion that looks like this, you think, ooh, this doesn't look good. But what are some of those, what are those diagnostic signs that we look for when you look at patients and they do that? What does this look like? Or when you're looking at your husband's skin or your children's skin, you know, what do you look for in a mole? So you're going to look for asymmetry. You look for the border to be regular. So if it's a typical benign nevus, it's what we call a mole in dermatology, it's going to be symmetrical. The edges are going to be smooth and round. It's typically going to be a uniform color. And typically, you know, not much larger than the diameter of a pencil eraser. It's just typical garden variety mole. We all have a monus, I imagine. The malignant lesion of malignant melanoma, it's asymmetrical, and we call it the ABCDEs of malignant melanoma. So it's asymmetrical. The border is irregular. The color, typically more than one color is contained within this lesion. And the diameter is typically larger than a pencil eraser, and it's elevated, but it's kind of a rocky elevation, not a smooth elevation. This is the skin cancer that kills you. You know, it metastasizes, and while we have some chemotherapeutic treatments available now for malignant melanoma, it's a devastating skin cancer. So, as I said, if you take nothing else away from this presentation, I want you to be able to spot a malignant melanoma, or at least be thinking about the ABCDEs of malignant melanoma when you're looking at your skin and the skin of your family members and your patients. So it's the leading fatal illness which arises in the skin. But it can be cured if it's detected early. So key, if you see a change in a pigmented lesion that meets any of these criteria, you need to have the area looked at. Malignant melanoma can spread to any organ in the body. And typically, the patient will relate to you a history of repeated blistering sunburns as a child. And there is thought that there's a genetic predistribution to malignant melanoma. So take-home message there. You know, again, sun protection is critical in the prevention of malignant melanoma, and certainly we know that the vast majority of damage to a patient's skin occurs before the age of 18. So protect your children and your grandchildren. This beautiful little child right here is actually this child that actually rang my cell phone just a few minutes ago. This is my daughter when she was 18 months old, doing what, you know, kids, that little girls like to do at that age. If you give them some lotion and say, here, rub it all on so mommy can take your picture. She was having a really good time. So questions, comments? I think that's all I wanted to cover. I think I stayed on time. You guys did really well, considering the fact it's after lunch, it's middle of the afternoon, the lights are dimmed. So I'm very impressed. And I want to thank you for your patience and your attention this afternoon. Questions? So let's see here.